This will be the third part, and I think the final part of a three-part series called Peaceful Under Pressure. Started 2 weeks ago, and we talked about how in order to be peaceful, you need to resolve four issues. Who am I? Where does the responsibility for the way my life lie? What are my priorities, and how do I view difficulties in life? Until you resolve these four issues, you could be in the most peaceful, so-called, quote-unquote, place in the world with lotus flowers and lakes and people waiting on you hand and feet. If you haven't resolved who am I, what are my responsibilities in life, what are the things that are important in life, and how I'm going to live my life, you're not going to be peaceful. On the other hand, you could be in the middle of a battle, just as Arjuna was after the Bhagavad Gita was spoken to him. And he was in an extremely dangerous situation. He was vying with lethal opponents who were trying to kill him. He was trying to kill them. And yet at the same time, because he'd resolved these four issues, he was peaceful in mind. Krishna had spent the 700 verses of the Bhagavad Gita walking Arjuna through these issues one by one. And whereas at the beginning, when he hadn't resolved those issues, he was very confused, paralyzed, unhappy. At the end, after those four issues were resolved, then he was able to engage in a great battle and at the same time be peaceful in his own mind. So we talked about the need to resolve these four issues in order to be peaceful. And the irony of it is, we started this series of shows 3 weeks ago, and we've only resolved one of those issues. We dedicated the first week to an introduction, and then the second week we dealt with the first issue, which is who am I? And so we still have, presumably you're not peaceful yet, and neither am I, because we haven't gone through our whole menu. So hopefully we'll take these next three in rapid succession, and by the end of the evening, we'll have finally achieved that peace that we started out to achieve 3 weeks ago. Again, the issues are, who am I? Who do I want to be? What's really important? And how I'm going to live? Yesterday, or last week, we talked about the issue of identity. Who am I? And just briefly, if you weren't here, you need to go to the website and download those two previous talks, and that'll give you a context for where we are now. But in a nutshell, I'm not this body. I am the entity, the driver of the body. I'm not the body itself. You may think that you're seeing your husband. Toda Gopinath may think that he sees Jeanette every day. Jeanette may think that she sees Toda Gopinath every day. But actually, neither one see the other. They're seeing not the selves, but they're seeing the bodies in which the selves are situated. We gave the example last week. If you see a car with tinted windows, we know there's someone inside. Because this car is accelerating, the car is decelerating, the car is turning left, and the car is turning right. And unless there was an entity in the car, it wouldn't be exhibiting all those symptoms of motion. But because the windows are tinted, we can't actually see who's in the car. So you may think you're seeing your brother, you may think you're seeing your sister, your father, your husband or wife, but you're seeing their body. Because the body is in motion, they're speaking, they're seeing, they're willing, we can successfully infer that there's a living entity inside, but we don't have the spiritual eyes to see the spiritual entity inside each and every body. And when we realize that we're spirit and we're not material, it resolves a lot of issues. It takes away a lot of fear. It takes away the fear of death. It takes away the fear of death. Right away, in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says to Arjuna, Nato evaham jatu nasham, Natvam neme janav dipaha, natchaiva nabhavishyavi sarve vaya matapara. Krishna says, God says, never was there a time when I did not exist. Well, nothing new there. We all know that God's eternal. But then he goes on to say, nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. So he's asserting from the highest authority that we know of, the mouth of the Lord himself, that not only is he eternal, but we're also eternal. Even though God is great and we're small, we have the same qualities as he does. The sun globe is unlimitedly powerful, and the sunshine particles are very limitedly powerful. And yet at the same time, you can't say that the sun existed before the sunshine. You can't say that the sunshine existed before the sun. So as God is eternal, we his parts and parcel, we're also eternal. So that should relieve us of a lot of stress. That should help us reduce our heartbeat, reduce our level of stress and tension right there. But we're not going to leave it there. These are some of the issues and some of the slides that we showed last week that had to do with identity. And we'll just flip through those really, really quickly and get to the second issue, which has to do with personal responsibility. What our lives have turned out to be thus far and what will turn out to be in the future are based on the choices that we make. So much of our self-improvement courses have to do with abnegating. I have a bad habit, so I have to stop it. I have an eating disorder, so I have to stop it. But the problem is, you can't not do something. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, na karmanam anarambam, naiskamyam purushanoshita. You cannot not do something, not even for a moment. That's why diets don't work. I can't eat sugar. I don't want to eat sugar because it'll make me gain weight. So especially those nice chocolate chip cookies which are just right out of the oven and smell so darn good and so tempting, which someone, my loving wife, is offering me right now, I can't eat those. The problem is that you're always thinking of cookies, and so sooner or later you're going to break down. The problem with diets is you're always thinking about food. So you can't just not eat cookies, but you have to substitute eating cookies with something better. You have to substitute the lower with the higher. So there's two parts to resolving this issue. There's refusing, okay, I'm refusing the cookies, but that's not it. That's not going to do the job. I'm refusing the cookies, but I'm choosing a nice apple. Or I'm choosing a nice orange. And gradually, over the course of about 3 or 4 weeks, by making the choice of the apple over the cookie or the candy bar, gradually you've got yourself a new wholesome habit. And you start to look forward to eating apple with the same enthusiasm and the same salivation that you used to anticipate eating the candy bar or the cookie. So you refuse, but also choose. Refuse the bad, but choose the good. Replace a negative with a positive. Life is not just a bunch of don'ts. Unfortunately, most religious people go through life looking like they just bit on a lemon, and because they're always thinking of the things they can't do. And some of the greatest misuses and abuses have been caused by religious people all over the world. Religion doesn't have a good track record. In fact, a case could be made that religious people have a worse track record than people who aren't religious. Because it's all about, oh, I can't do that. I can't fornicate. I can't commit adultery. I can't covet my neighbor's property. And because you're thinking of those things all the time, then it busts out. You see what I'm saying? It's like shaking up the soda bottle. Sooner or later, it's going to explode. I've told this story before about two Buddhist monks. They were celibates. And as a celibate Buddhist monk, you have nothing to do with the fair sex. Nothing wrong with the fair sex, but it says man is like butter, woman is like fire. And if you want to keep cool, you keep your distance between the butter and the fire. So they came to a river one time, and there was a lady, a very attractive young lady, and she couldn't get across the river. So she asked the monks, would one of you be kind enough to carry me across the river? And the monk went, no way, I'm celibate, no way. And the other monk said, sure. He picked her up, he carried her across the river, and her garments got soaked, and he put her down, and they started continuing on their journey. And the one monk said, I can't believe you did that. I can't. You're supposed to be celibate. You're not even supposed to be thinking about women. And here you had one in your arms, and her garment was wet and like blah, 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 blah. And finally the first monk, he said, wait, he said, I've had enough of this. He said, hold your horses there, Haas. He said, I picked up the lady and took her across the water. It took about 60 seconds. I put her down and I forgot about her. But you have been holding on to her for the last 90 minutes. Like that. So give it a break, okay? Give it a break. The point is that life is not just a bunch of don'ts. If it's all about don'ts, you're not alive. You're a dead person. It's choosing the do's. It's refusing certain things and choosing certain other things. And this is a mark of spiritual maturity. Those who are spiritually immature, and you might even say repressed, you see, and unpredictable, are those people who are living their life by negatives. Can't, shall not, shall not, shall not, shall not. This is spiritual immaturity. We're meant to grow and to achieve maturity. Children are cute. Nikunj is famous for attracting attention. She's just, every single move she makes, every little dimple in her cheeks and every gesture you know, it's hard to keep your eyes off of her. It's just cute. It's just cute. Even when she trips and falls or something, there's just something cute about it. You love to go and pinch her cheeks and all like that. But her parents, while they're perfectly happy and perfectly delighted and perfectly entertained with her at 4 years old, their ultimate long-range hopes for her are that she'll become a mature, self-contained young lady. Educated, articulate, and less spontaneous, you see. If she's still acting like a four-year-old when she's 24, the parents will be brokenhearted. It's okay to act like a four-year-old when you're four, but if when you're 24 you haven't grown up, if you haven't transcended childhood, then your parents will literally be brokenhearted because they want you to be able to stand on your own. So living your life through negative rules and petty rules and all like that is not an indication of spiritual maturity. And the greatest choice that we can make, the greatest choice that we can make to fill up our lives with meaning and satisfaction and good companionship is to choose to associate with spiritually advanced people. With spiritually advanced people. It is stated in one of our scriptures, the perfection of the eyes is to see other devotionally minded people. The perfection of the ears is to hear the conversations of other spiritual people based on scriptures like the Bhagavad Gita, the Torah, and the Talmud. The perfection of the elbows and the arms is to rub shoulders with them while you're chanting and dancing, singing the holy names of the Lord, such as Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. The greatest choice and the most significant choice that we can make in life is to whom we will associate. You can break it down and you can fragment it and you can say, okay, well, I have choice about what movies to see, I have choices about what books to read, I have choice about what neighborhoods to live in, I have choices about what food to eat. But all that, if you choose to associate with saintly people, then all those other choices are already made. What books are you going to read? Spiritual books, enlivening books, purifying books. What food are you going to eat? Meatless, non-vegetarian food, meatless, non-flesh foods that are attained without violence and without bloodshed. What are you going to talk about? You're going to talk about the Lord and His works and His enterprises and His mission. What are you going to build? Are you going to build temples? Everything, dance, arts, performing arts, festivals, everything will fall into place if you simply choose the association of those who are dedicated to the service of the Lord. Here it's said in the Srimad Bhagavatam, persons who are peaceful, equipoised, cleansed and purified, keep friendship only with devotees of the Lord. They alone can very easily achieve the perfection of going back home, back to Godhead. Have you ever met someone that started out religious, started out with a lot of gusto, a lot of fervor, and I don't know, just over the course of time, some or other, they got lukewarm about it? Have you ever met anybody in that, as a Mormon, or as a Catholic, or as a Krishna? I know, I've met lots of people. They started up, don't point, don't nod, don't rub your elbow, don't rub anybody in the rib. I've met lots of people like that. They started out and they were fired up and they were enthusiastic. And then in due course of time, they just got more and more lukewarm and lukewarm and lukewarm and indifferent. It's like an ember. As long as the ember stays close to the fire, the ember is bursting with light and heat and the same energy as the fire. But once the ember, you know, steps away a little bit, you know, it gets a little less light, full of light. And then one step leads to another, one step. And as it the more it distances itself from the fire, it loses those qualities of light and heat. So the illusion is that I can maintain my spirituality and not associate, not commingle with other spiritually minded people. It's not possible. It's like an ember saying, I can go away from the fire and still be full of light and heat. It just doesn't happen. Without association of devotees, one cannot maintain that enthusiasm that one had in the beginning. And in fact, the enthusiasm that one had in the beginning was devotees, you know. Devotees were your life and soul. They were be all, the end all. You wanted nothing more when you got up in the morning to see devotees. You wanted nothing more to have a cup of hot banana milk with the devotees before you went to bed. You wanted nothing more than go out and distribute books with the devotees and sit down and take prasadam with the devotees. You know? And that's the source of your enthusiasm. And then we wonder, well, why I'm not fired up anymore? Because how much time do you spend with the devotees? So association is the single most important choice that you can make. You will reflect the characteristics of those with whom you associate. Now, a lot of us have to go to work and we have to associate throughout the day with unlike-minded people. Therefore, we have a program to keep our head above water. It's called the spiritual sandwich. We get up early in the morning, we chant our rounds on our beads, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, according to a scheduled measurement. We sing the samsara prayers to the Guru. We have a little Bhagavad Gita discussion with our family members. And thus fortified, thus girded, we go off to work, you see. And hopefully that's given us enough enthusiasm that rather than being negatively affected by those with whom we work, we positively affect them. We can pass out copies of the Bhagavad Gita. We can talk to them about spiritual matters. We can bring them cookies which have been offered to Krishna. We have one fellow who works at Tahitian Noni, and he's an artist. He's sort of a pop artist, you see. And he draws these pictures with crayons and watercolors, and they all have a sort of an uplifting spiritual message. So he took me through the workplace at Tahitian Noni, not the front mall place, which is for the visitors, but up to the workstation. And every single cubicle has one of his pictures with a little spiritually uplifting caption. So here is someone who, because they fortified themselves in the morning program, not only are they not negatively affected by the association of work, but they're positively influencing and transforming the lives of people who they work with. And the proof is, those people end up coming. They end up bringing them to the temple because they want to know what it is that you have. They're intrigued by it, the buoyancy, the enthusiasm, the optimism, and they want a piece of it. And so they're going to end up here at your invitation. And that's the proof that you're taking that kind of association into work. And we can't blame anyone else. If we're not bouncing out of bed in the morning, getting the gusto and feeling life with full satisfaction, we can't blame that on anyone else. Many, many times we've said, you spell lame, be lame. Oh, I'd be more committed if my family were devotees. I would go God's way more if my wife and my boyfriend would. I'd be a better person if I'd had a different upbringing. It's like this lady who says to her husband, we'd make a perfect team if it wasn't for you. And another significant choice that we can make in life is we can't choose what happens to us. We can't choose what happens to us. We're not in control. We can't predict even the next moment, what to speak of down the road. We spend our whole life trying to control things and trying to manipulate in such a way as to get a particular outcome, but actually none of that is under our control. The only thing that's under our control is the endeavor and the willpower that we put into it, but the end result, it is out of our control. But what is in our control is our response to what happens to us. That is entirely within our control. If something happens to us, we can say, God, why did you do this to me? Or we can say, God, what lesson do you want me to learn from this? As a result of the things that happen to us, which are out of our control, we can get bitter about it. What's the point? It's out of your control. So why get bitter about it? Why get bitter about something that's just impossible in the first place? I'm bitter because I'm not God. Well, what's the point? What's the percentage in that? You're not in control, so instead of getting bitter, use the experiences that you have to get better. When you get lemons, make lemonade. And this has to do with accepting responsibility. Each and every one of us are where we are in life because of the choices that we've made, not because of anything else that anyone else has done or anything else that's happened. No one has the power to ruin your life except you yourself. How many of you have heard of Viktor Frankl? Good for you. Good for you. He was treated like all the other Buchenwald, Auschwitz, the SS, the Waffen. They treated them like less than animals. They would kill them on a whim. And he couldn't control that. He made an assessment. He's in the concentration camp. And he couldn't control that. There's nothing that he could control. I don't think any set of people in the history of the world felt less in control than people in the concentration camps in World War II. Someone could just kill you at a whim. But he realized the most important lesson in life, that while we can't control external circumstances and the things that happen, we can control our response to them. So he decided he was going to treat the guards and the sadists and the Nazis with the same courtesy that he would like them to treat him. And he said, no one can take away your attitude unless you give it away. No one can ruin your life except you. No one can take it away except you. So each one of us have to assume responsibility for our own attitudes and make the right choices. Now the third issue, the second to last issue that we have to resolve in order to be peaceful under pressure is priority. What are the things that are important to us in life? Now if you list the things that are most important to most people, they are these: pleasure, power, popularity, possessions. So let's look at some of these and see if they'll give you satisfaction, see if they'll give you peace. Popularity. You know, how many high school homecoming kings, homecoming queens, quarterbacks of the football team, you know, all the inset. You know, where are they now and who cares? Who cares? 1 minute a hero, the next minute a zero. Who cares? Here's popular trees and here's not very popular trees. Flame, what is it? Once in India reigned a king who upon his signet ring engraved a maxim true and wise, which if held before the eyes, gave him counsel at a glance, fit for any change in chance, solemn words, and these were they, even this will pass away. You see. Even fame is but a slow decay. Fame is but a slow decay. Even this will pass. As soon as you stand up on the podium as the gold medal winner, as soon as you stand up, after that first second is over, already people are forgetting. I saw a cartoon. There's the bronze and the silver and the gold, and they're up there like that with the garlands and holding it up like that. And then, and 5 minutes, and there's a huge crowd. And then 5 minutes later, the crowd is halved. 10 minutes later, the crowd is a quarter. 15 minutes later, he's standing up there, and there's nobody in the field at all. That's how fast it goes. 1 minute a hero, 1 minute zero. So what's the point of setting as a dominant life principle popularity, pleasure? Kicks give kickbacks. Look at this girl here. Look at this girl. Look at the hands. Take it. This is a girl who gives away herself. She gives away her time. She gives away her body. She gives away her energy. She gives away the valuable moments and seconds of her life. She's influenced by her friends. She looks at TV. She smokes cigarettes. Whatever advertisement comes down the pike, she's a sucker for it. She's being robbed. She's being robbed. Kicks give kickbacks. Nothing comes free. If you want to build a high-rise building, if you want to build a building that's abnormally high, above the ground, a skyscraper, somewhere there's a hole equally deep. Somewhere, in order to get the concrete to build that high-rise, somewhere they had to dig down in. So there's always a price. There's always a price for material pleasures. Once Allen Ginsberg, the LDS... Sorry, I'm very sorry. That was a real bad slip of the tongue. LSD. The LSD poet of the 60s. I did not mean anything. But the LSD poet of the 60s told Prabhupada, he said, don't you think that Krishna might have had the pleasure to incarnate in this age in the form of an LSD pill? And Prabhupada said, the problem with taking something material for your stimulus, for your pleasure, is it follows material laws. And what's the most basic of all material laws? What goes up comes down. And the higher it goes up, the lower it goes down. That's why when you take Prozac, you increase your chances of committing suicide. You increase your chance. When you take more people who take antidepressants commit suicide than people who didn't take them in the first place, who just wrote it out. Because what goes unnaturally high will bring you unnaturally low. And depression that you could normally bear, some of the greatest people in the world were depressed. Clinically depressed. And yet as a result of that tension, great art, great architecture, great poetry came about. They learned how to deal with it without stimulus. We had the joke last week, it's past, but it's a picture of Leonardo da Vinci painting the Mona Lisa. And he says, and she's got this stupid, you know, instead of that enigmatic smile, you know, which is fascinated people for hundreds and hundreds of years, Mona Lisa's got this stupid, goofy, ear-to-ear grin. And Leonardo da Vinci says, I liked you better before you started taking Prozac. So pleasure is a corkscrew ride. You end up where you started with less intelligence, less brain cells, and less time of your life. Pleasure is just another way of being robbed. Wealth? Well, let's think of some of the wealthy people that have passed away within our generation. There was Howard Hughes. There was Hunt. There was Getty. MacArthur, Onassis, and tabloids and newspapers, they always have these articles. How much did they leave behind? How much when Onassis died, how much did he leave behind? When Howard Hughes died, how much did he leave behind? I happen to know exactly how much each one of those left behind. Would you like to know? Everything. Everything. They left it all behind. They couldn't take a penny with them. And so what is the purpose of pursuing taking the valuable days and moments of our life for using, for getting money? It says, if you love money, you'll use people. If you love money, you'll use people. If you make money and accumulating stuff your priority in life, and you love stuff, you'll use people, you'll manipulate people in order to get stuff. But if you make relationships priority in your life, then you'll use stuff and you'll use money to help people out. That's the difference. Here it is said by Lord Shiva himself, and again, the context for this, if you just came in this week, is that Lord Shiva, just as Krishna instructed Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita and resolved these issues, similarly, Lord Shiva came to these bachelors who were preparing themselves for married life, named the Prachetas, and in the same way that Krishna instructed Arjuna, Lord Shiva is instructing the Prachetas about how to be peaceful under pressure. And Lord Shiva here is talking, glorifying Lord Krishna, and also instructing the Prachetas. And he says, "My dear Lord, all living entities within this material world are mad after planning for things. And they are always busy with a desire to do this or that. This is due to uncontrollable greed. But your lordship is always alert. And in due course of time, you strike him just as a snake seizes a mouse and very easily swallows him. In the middle of all this plan-making business for power, for wealth, for pleasure, for popularity, in the middle of all that, at some point, like a snake which has been poised always to strike, we are grabbed and we are swallowed up." And that's the abrupt and traumatic end to all of our plan-making experiences. But if your priority in life is to establish your relationship with God and your relationship with God-conscious people as the most important thing in your life, then you'll never be robbed, you'll never be cheated by the snake of time. You'll never be. Because what you're doing here is worshiping the Lord and associating with His devotees. What will you be doing after death? Here you're worshiping the Lord in His deity form, singing, organizing festivals, speaking the philosophy, sharing sanctified foodstuffs, enjoying the association of other like-minded people. So what will you be doing at the time of death, after death? The very same thing. You will go to Krishna's eternal abode. You will organize festivals. You will sing. You will dance. You will speak the philosophy. You will share transcendental spiritual meals with like-minded people. So what threat does death hold for such a person? What threat does death hold? What was that poem? "Death, where is thy victory? Grave, where is thy sting?" You see? "Those who are after fruit of results for their pious activities." Now these are all who are unpeaceful, who are not peaceful, who have temporary aims and goals and ambitions. "Those who are after fruit of results for their pious activities, those who desire salvation and who want to become one with the Supreme, those who desire material perfections of mystic power are all restless." That means they're not peaceful because they want something for themselves. But the devotee is completely peaceful because he has no demand for himself and is always ready to serve the desire of the Lord. Here's a poem, one of my favorite poems. The author is Ethelyn Weatherald, and she wrote about service. "My orders are to fight, and if I bleed or fall or strongly win, what matters it? God only doth prevail. The servant craveth not except to serve with might. I was not told to win or lose. My orders are to fight." If that is your highest ambition, to serve the Lord and serve the devotees, what can disturb you? What can disturb you? Even death itself will not disturb you. You only want to serve, and death cannot take away the service. Your service is not contingent upon success or failure. Sometimes you'll fail. Sometimes you'll succeed. It doesn't matter. The service is always there, and that's what devotees ask for. "Let me always serve the Lord and serve His devotees." Then you'll never be disturbed, no matter how much pressures there are around you. And the last issue we need to resolve to become completely peaceful is difficulty. How do we view difficulty in our life? You know, most of us spend our life trying to surround ourselves with comforts. You know, how many billions and billions of dollars of painkillers are sold every year? Because we can't stand a little pain. We can't stand a little inconvenience. But as it said, no pain, no gain. No achievement, no advancement without adversity. In the gym, they have this time-honored and time technique tested to increase your strength. It's called resistance training. Resistance training. If you went in the gym and picked up feathers, there would be no advancement. There'd be, show us what you got there, John. Show us, show those pythons, guy. Because he goes, he doesn't pick up feathers. Yeah. There's resistance. And when you push against the resistance, then you get results. You see what I'm saying? No advancement without adversity. No progress without problems. Life is not about comforts. And it's actually antithetical. The purpose that we're put here for is to develop character. To learn how to serve the Lord and serve the Lord's devotees. It's not about being the Lord, being the monarch of all we survey, about my and mine. It's about God and God's. Here's a picture of a guy, an older guy, finishing the 26.2 miles of the marathon. And his time is not the fastest time. The winner of this marathon probably broke the tape at about probably 2 hours and 6 minutes. So he's more than, if they could stop talking downstairs, that would be good. 2 hours and 6 minutes. So he's more than twice as slow as this person. But he didn't give up. He endured and he finished. It says sometimes problems bring you to your knees. And that's where we need to be. That's exactly where we need to be. No problems, we're not brought to our knees. We need to be on our knees one time and not cop out when there's a problem. Prabhupada, our guru, the founder of this international society, which has 400 temples all over the world and is growing day by day, he was comfortably ensconced in Vrindavan. Vrindavan is the holiest place of all of India. It's the place where the Lord appeared 5,000 years ago and exhibited his wonderful transcendental pastimes. There are 5,000 temples in this village of 50,000 people. That's one temple every 10 people. So do you think there's an atmosphere of peacefulness and piety and quietude? Yes, there is. And there's saints and sages that live there and that have lived there that permeate the whole atmosphere. And as I said, Krishna himself was there with his devotees 5,000 years ago. So why would anyone want to leave Vrindavan? Why would any... You're there. You just have to stay there, chant, associate with the holy people, and you're guaranteed to go back to the spiritual. Why would anyone want to leave Vrindavan? For service. For service. Why would they want to leave the comfort of our Bethlehem in order to go to a Western country where people are taking LSD and eating meat and promoting free love? Why would they do that? For the further development of character. To take a risk for their Lord and Master. And we have Jahir. Jahir is always trying to get my attention. And we have about 5 or 6 other birds too. So they all have their own particular ways of trying to get our attention. Jai hangs upside down from his cage. And he makes all these kinds of water sounds to try and get my attention, you see. The other parrots have different means of getting my attention. So why would someone leave the holy place where they're comfortable? Because they want to get the attention of the Lord. They want to do something special for the Lord. And that's natural. You know, if you have 5 or 6 kids, everyone is trying to do something that's different and excels above each and every one of those. So Krishna came to him in the form of his spiritual master and also in dreams, and he said, get out of the comfort zone. Go to the West. And Prabhupada was shocked and horrified initially, but he came to regard it as a great opportunity, a window of opportunity that he could jump through. And even though he was one of many, many hundreds of God brothers initiated by his spiritual master, he alone is the one who in the spiritual world gets the credit for spreading the teachings of Bhagavad Gita and Krishna all over the world. All over the world. Every one of his God brothers was destined to go back to the spiritual world because they never did any sin. They never had any illicit sex, no gambling, no intoxication, never ate meat in their lives. So hundreds and hundreds of them, all initiated by the Guru, were all destined to go back to the spiritual world. So why would anyone want to do anything more than that? They've got it made. But yet, out of all of those, he's the one that spread Krishna consciousness all over the world. Maybe when you were young, you were in a baseball game, right? And your team won the baseball game, and so you're all huddled around. The coach says, huddle up. All right? And he says, Ken, you pitched a really good game. I really like it that you struck out 10 batters. And Dave, when you went up to the fence and you won the game by catching that ball, you jumping up and catching that ball, before, that was really good, you know? And Mary, you played a good game too, and Coda played a good game too. Which person would you rather be? You know, you muffed a fly ball, you made a couple of errors, you struck out three times. You know, I don't want to make you feel bad, so I said, yeah, Al, you played a good game, Tony, you played a good game. But Dave, I love the way you pitched, and wow, the way you snagged that fly ball, way to go, okay? So when you get to the spiritual world, you want God to say, yeah, good, you played it safe, you chanted Hare Krishna, vegetarian, yeah, that's cool. But here's the one that left the comfort zone, the holy dump, went and lived in the Bowery, you see, amongst hippies and criminals, and at risk of his life, he spread Krishna consciousness, he spread love of God, and he is the conduit, the link, through which hundreds of thousands of people who would have never even heard about Krishna are now here in the spiritual world. Which one would you rather be? And is it worth it to take a little risk in this short life of 60 or 70 years? In order to get that special recognition. Here it is said, a devotee can handle the difficulties of this material world and is not anxious to stop the repetition of birth and death. This is another criticism. When Prabhupada was getting ready to go to the West, not only was he told that you can never be successful, but he was told that you may lose what you have. The comfort, the serenity, the spiritual acquisitions that you have in the dawn. When you go to the West and you hang out with these hippies and these crazy Westerners that are all about pleasure and power and money and wealth, you may even lose the spiritual assets that you have. You see. But he was undaunted and he didn't listen to them. It says here that he's not anxious to... They were saying, you may lose your salvation. You may lose your... Now you're saved. If you go to the West, go to New York, Boston, Chicago, the Haight-Ashbury, you may no longer be saved. You may get rub off all the sin and polluted, may rub off, and you may lose your salvation. And it says here, he didn't care because he wasn't serving the Lord for salvation. If you're serving the Lord for salvation, you're not going to be peaceful. He was serving the Lord because that's what we are. We're servants. That's what we are, eternally, constitutionally, servants. So he didn't even care if he were to lose his salvation by going to the West. He only wanted to serve. And so it continued. He's always eager to associate with other devotees who are engaged in chanting and hearing about the glories of the Lord. He was associating with people in the holy dham. Everywhere you turn, if you go to Vrindavan, everywhere there's a chanting of the holy names of the Lord. Even at night. You know, when you go to Vrindavan, in the summer it's hot and you don't want to sleep inside. So you go up on the roof with a mosquito net. And all night long, you never forget God in the holy place with Prabhupada left. Because there are temples in Vrindavan, about 3 or 4 dozen temples in Vrindavan, where they have been chanting the names of the Lord. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare. They have been singing that in the courtyard of the temple nonstop for over 500 years. And there are a dozen temples, or 2 dozen temples like that. So when you're lying on the roof, you're hearing from down the street, from 100 yards away, Hare Krishna, and then from 2 miles away, another tune, another melody, another mile away, Sitaram, Lakshman, Hanuman. You never, ever forget Krishna. But he thought, if I can go to the Western countries, and if I can get even 2 or 3 people to chant, then it'll be the same. It'll be the same as Vrindavan, because the spiritual world is where there's Lord, and his devotees, and the service. And the best way you can serve the Lord is to take your God-given tongue and chant his holy names, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Use your ears to listen to the names of the Lord, your eyes to see the beautiful form of the Lord, your nose to smell the incense and flowers that are offered to the Lord. This is service. So, we're finishing this series, and hopefully, those of you who have been coming, precious few for the whole series. You're looking more peaceful than you did 3 weeks ago. So maybe, hopefully, just maybe, and if you haven't heard the 2 previous lectures, you're welcome to download them, and the PowerPoints are there from the website. Maybe, just maybe, in the last 3 weeks, we're a little bit more peaceful because we've settled these issues. The issue of who are you? Are you trying to be someone you're not? Because God created you to be you. When you get to the spiritual world, he's not going to ask you, why weren't you more like someone else? He's going to say, why weren't you more like you? So are you who you are? An eternal servant of the Lord, serving according to your unique talents and abilities. Are you where you are today because you chose to be there? Are you where you are because you made the right choices? The right choices. Or did you make the wrong choices? Or did you let other people make choices for you? Did you simply react? Did you allow yourselves to be carried along by the waves of time and association, cravings and so on and so forth? Have you been guided in your life up to this point by priorities, or have you been guided by pressures? Have you seen difficulties? Have you seen problems as opportunities? Because if you have, if you've answered affirmatively, you're more peaceful. And your peace is not contingent upon an ideal utopian external surrounding. Your peace is internal. It's unshakable. It's unshakable. Prabhupada writes in this book, As They Surrender to Me, one who is engaged without a relationship with Krishna is certainly always in distress and is without peace, however much he may make a show of peace and spiritual advancement in life. Krishna consciousness is a self-manifested, peaceful condition which can be achieved only in relationship with Krishna. In the Bhagavad Gita, it is said, a person who is not disturbed by the incessant flow of desires that enter like rivers into the ocean, which is ever being filled but is always still, can alone achieve peace. Those are never agitated who are fixed in the service of the Lord. Yajman shtitu idukena gurinapi vichalyate. How many of us are peaceful when things are going our way, peaceful when we're surrounded by other cool people like us? But how many of us can be peaceful when there's huge upheavals, financial upheavals, emotional upheavals, marital upheavals, health upheavals? Here it says, Yajmin Stito, who is fixed in these four areas, who has the right priorities, who has the right view of problems, who takes responsibility and makes the right choices, and who knows who they are as a spiritual soul, the greatest calamity can befall them. The greatest calamity can befall them, and they still think, I am so lucky. I am so fortunate. Nothing can dislodge them. Peaceful, under pressure. And after having given this advice to the Prachetas, the young men who went to the bank of the river to do austerities and prepare themselves for the responsibilities of married life and parenthood, having been instructed by Lord Shiva, the great devotee of Lord Krishna, just as Arjuna was instructed by Krishna, Lord Shiva finishes his instructions and gives them the benediction. You see this picture? In India, if you want to bless someone with peace, you raise your hand. So let's do that. Let's end this series. Those of you, you don't have to do it if you don't want to. Only if you want to bless other people with peace. If you don't want to bless other people with peace, just sit there with your hands on your lap. But if you want to bless other people with peace, raise your hands and say after me, Om Shanti, 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 Shanti. And with that mudra, that gesture, Lord Shiva concludes, my dear sons of the kings, the prayers that I've recited to you are meant for pleasing the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I advise you to recite these mantras, which are as effective as great austerities. In this way, when you mature, your life will be successful, and you will certainly achieve all your desired objectives without fail. And again, from the Bhagavad Gita, the last verse, Krishna says, the sages knowing me as the ultimate purpose of all sacrifices and austerities, the Supreme Lord of all planets and demigods, and the benefactor and well-wisher of all living entities, attain peace from the pangs of material miseries. And actually, after Lord Shiva instructed the Prachetas and this knowledge lodged in their hearts, then Lord Krishna himself came in his multi-armed form as Lord Vishnu, riding on the back of Garuda. And then finally, to conclude the series, if you will, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Rama.